Hey, welcome to the weekly HODL with Shibs, where I bring you weekly Bitcoin adoption news and interviews from experts in the space. This week, I have with me a real Bitcoin expert and OG, Jameson Lopp. We chat about the overall state of the network, what he's paying specific attention to, and we have a detailed dive into Bitcoin self-custody and best demonstrated security practices. It's one you're not going to want to miss. Before we jump in, many of you know that I have partnered with Stampseed to help fortify your Bitcoin stamp with titanium seed stamping kits. We're normally running a 15% promotion if you use weekly HODL at checkout. But if you're watching this video before the end of November 27th, the promotion doesn't mean anything right now because everything's 21% off of the entire website for their cyber sale. So check that out. And then check out the rest of this video as we jump in right now. Jameson Lopp, welcome to the weekly HODL, man. Thank you so much for joining.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I first off just wanted to thank you for all your contributions and all your hard work to the Bitcoin protocol. And like I just told you before, my Chicago BitDev folks were super excited to hear that you were coming on. They sent me 1,000 different questions to ask you. Obviously, we have like an hour here, so I don't want to dive into all those, but I'll get into some of them with the hopes that we can kind of end on Bitcoin self-custody, best practices, and stuff like that. So again, thanks for joining.
All right, let's dive in.
Yeah, for sure. Well, also, before we start, I considered completely shaving my entire beard because I didn't want to be on the same screen with the best beard in Bitcoin. So compliments to that, by the way.
Well, I'll never achieve Greg Maxwell level beard. I realized that I have a natural length limit on mine because I stroke it too much and pull out too many hairs.
I do the same, but I don't have nearly as much as you got going on there. I love it. But for those who don't know you, can you give yourself a brief introduction as well as kind of like when you got into Bitcoin and how you've started interfacing with the protocol?
Yeah, I mean, I first heard about Bitcoin probably in 2010 or 2011 and summarily ignored it. It wasn't until 2012 when I started paying attention because I realized that it wasn't going away and crashing and burning like I had assumed. Played around with it for a year or so, not doing very much. I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot going on back then, and I wasn't deep into the technical weeds. It wasn't until late 2013, early 2014, I decided I wanted to dig deeper on the technical side. And so I forked Bitcoin Core, created a project I called Statoshi, which was basically leveraging what I was already doing at my day job as a DevOps, like infrastructure guy. Really just putting a lot of metrics and statistic reporting into Bitcoin Core so I could better understand, you know, the internal operations of the node. And, you know, over the decade since then, I've done a lot of things with Bitcoin nodes. I went full time about a year later for BitGo and was responsible for running all of their node and transaction sending and transaction indexing infrastructure for 3 years before I pivoted to Casa, which was just a small change really from doing a enterprise focused multi-sig self-custody to more of a individual focused multi-sig self-custody, you know, trying to take a lot of those best practices and employ them in better software design to essentially guide users down the right path, because we know that people aren't going to put in all the time and effort required to understand all the minutiae and potential footguns of self-custody. So this has really been my mission for the past 9 years now, is trying to make self-custody easier because I think it's obvious what the end game is if we don't do that. And basically it's the fact that we're faced with an adversary called convenience, and human nature seems to prefer convenience over all other things, unless you're like a really weird edge case person like myself. So if we don't continue to make it easier so that people can really be confident that they can be their own bank, then they're going to default to just letting a trusted third party do it for them, because they figure, you know, they're the expert and the expert will do a better job at it. So this is something that I think will continue to be ongoing for the foreseeable future, because these custodians are able to hide so much of the complexity of custody under the hood and just like present a shiny web interface, so that people are, you know, really used to if they're using traditional banking or other tools.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really, subject to that type of, you know, not being technical, I'm subject to the shiny, thing quite a bit. And I see that standpoint, and particularly, you know, here in America, where seemingly, you know, on the customer facing side of things, like, banks have worked somewhat properly, and people always believe that they've got their FDIC insurance and all the stuff that's available to them. They don't hesitate to put money in the bank unless they have kind of gone down a journey of learning and things like that. So I'll be interested to kind of touch base with you on a little bit later about the you know, those challenges and the challenges of you know, doing multi-sig, what is a multi-sig, and all of these, you know, how we bring that forward in something that is easy and familiar for people to work with, right? But before we go down the custody route, I would be remiss if I just didn't straight up ask you, like, what you're working on Bitcoin right now, what you're excited about, like, what is taking up kind of, like, you know, we know what you do for a job, but what is interesting to you right now in the Bitcoin protocol and what's going on?
Well, I think we've seen an explosion of development this year using Bitcoin as part of the tech stack. Now, this does upset a lot of purists who, you know, may not like some of the development that's happening, but basically I'm a fan of permissionless innovation. So whenever I see people doing new stuff, I figure, you know, this at worst is probably a neutral thing, and at best it, you know, it creates more interest in new use cases. So, you know, people playing around with these various Taproot based protocols, whether that's like ordinals, inscriptions, now mini scripts starting to become more of a thing, creating more complex locking conditions for your Bitcoin. That's interesting to me from a self-custody perspective. We're still in the early phase of that, where we haven't seen you know, mini script tooling and support get added by a non-negligible number of like wallets and hardware devices and stuff, but it's inching forward. So I'm interested in really just seeing what people can come up with, which is part of the reason why I've been participating in a variety of like accelerators and hackathons and stuff, just trying to help get more developers into the ecosystem. And you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of have to throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And this is capitalism. This is entrepreneurship. Ultimately, a lot of these things will fail, and they will, you know, not achieve product market fit for whatever reason. And that's fine. But if even a small percent of them succeed, then I think that's good for Bitcoin as a whole.
Yeah. So you talked about the purists maybe not liking some of these things, and Miniscript, correct me if I'm wrong, but like this allows for like time locking of Bitcoin and stuff like that. Can you explain the mini script a little bit just so the viewers know what it is and
Yeah, well, so it's kind of weird because ultimately, nothing over the past couple of years has fundamentally changed what you can do with Bitcoin script. It was always possible to create more complex Bitcoin scripts, but what we've had is a sort of multi-phase improvement in the efficiency of how you can code them up. So Taproot was a big deal because it allows you with TapScript to create these essentially Merkle trees of script so that you only end up having to reveal the part of the script that you're executing. So you can create arbitrarily complex scripts with a million different logical branches and not have to pay exorbitant on-chain fees and have huge transaction sizes because you don't have to reveal all of it. So it's good from like a scalability and a privacy perspective. Miniscript is kind of the next iteration forward in that. And it's just like it's a higher level language that makes it easier for developers to compose more complex scripts and be confident that they don't have, security holes. So that and Miniscript will also ties in to something called wallet descriptors, which is another thing that we haven't seen a ton of adoption yet around. But I think wallet descriptors are going to be very important to be a standard. Basically, if you want all wallets to be able to like talk the same language, if you want to be able to take your wallet with one wallet software and use it in other wallet software, really the only low friction way to do that would be if all of these different wallets support descriptors. Otherwise, you usually end up having to know three or four different variables of like the wallet configuration, like the script type and the derivation path and the pub keys and all this stuff. And wallet descriptors just put all of that necessary information into one blob, which you can even represent as a QR code in some cases. So yeah, it's small steps. It's like taking the functionality that has been there all along and just making it more scalable, more private, and more developer friendly.
Yeah. And so where would those purists come in and say, like, doing things like this or creating certain, abilities using Bitcoin the way that it currently is an issue?
Yeah, so there's a conflict, I think, between people who see Bitcoin just as digital gold, simple store of value, versus those of us, more on the technology side who see Bitcoin as programmable money or as a distributed database with very interesting properties. I've said many times over the years that, one of the reasons the white paper blew my mind is because I felt like the solution was both elegant and ass backwards. And it was ass backwards in the sense that my computer engineering teachings, the way that I was trained to approach problems in computer science, was to always seek efficiency, both from a like data and memory storage and CPU cycles, like all of the resources that you're constrained by in the real world at the hardware level. You always want to maximize the efficiency of, what computation you can perform because your hardware is always going to be limited. And Bitcoin sort of flipped that model on its head and said, you know what, we're going to use a flood fill network. We're going to transmit every transaction to every person on there, and they're going to have to store it forever. So that solved one of the fundamental problems, but of course it created a major scaling issue. And so I do, in a sense, I see Bitcoin as a database, and it does, I think you can't really can't make a claim with a straight face that Bitcoin isn't programmable. I mean, it has a scripting language, albeit it's a very basic and very limited for security purposes scripting language. So, whenever you have a database and a programming language, you should expect that savvy developers are going to find creative ways to use it to do things that you may not have anticipated. And some of those may be, you know, non-monetary use cases. So, you know, people can whine about that if they want, but obviously this is permissionless innovation. Developers who figure out ways to leverage the attributes of the network don't need to get anybody's buy-in if they're using the functionality that's already there.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, right? The permissionless system. And so you're a known like freedom advocate. Where does the conflict come in with the idea of, you know, building some of these things, programming this programmable money, but also, you know, the topic that we hear some of like ossification of certain parts of the network? What are your thoughts on like what portions need to be ossified, or if the whole, you know, base layer does, versus, you know, what needs continuous innovation to expand to allow this type of, you know, we're all, you know, 8 billion people can get in on this.
Right. Well, you know, there are different factions, obviously, within the developer portion of the community, or at least like the people who are closer to the protocol. I think you'll be very hard pressed to find any who say we need to stop changing the protocol right now. And the reason for that is they're so close to the protocol, they understand all the problems with it, like all the challenges ahead. I've stepped back a bit and tried to describe this in several talks that I've given over the past year or so, which is essentially that my understanding of, you know, people who want to ossify now and never change the protocol again is that basically they are afraid of unintended consequences of changing the protocol. And they'll probably in many cases point to, you know, Taproot and the people who are finding novel uses for Taproot. But, you know, we're talking about a tool here. And so tools, of course, can be used for subjectively good things and subjectively bad things. You know, if we didn't have a Taproot, then we probably wouldn't have Taproot assets. Now, some purists will say, well, people are going to start shitcoining and creating tokens on Lightning with Taproot assets. Sure, I mean, that's the natural result of permissionless innovation. The other side of it is that I think we're going to see stable coins on Lightning. And I think, you know, Lightning plus stable coins is a much more attractive medium of exchange that can not only compete with, but probably surpass the, you know, existing networks like Visa, MasterCard, American Express, whatever. So good and bad. Yeah. I think that in general, the good is always going to outweigh the bad. That's because I'm an optimist. And I think that, you know, most people want to do generally good things and not harm others. But you know, whenever you create a tool, it will be used by criminals. It will be used by scammers. I think it's hard to say, you know, we should not allow the, you know, single digit percent of psychopaths and sociopaths out there the ability to do these things, and we should hamstring what the other 90 something percent of the populace is able to do just because of that tiny percent.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the local guys here wrote an article on ossification and the idea that Lightning, you know, allows things to scale to a certain extent, right? But it also potentially eliminates the ability to do some of the core things that Bitcoin was meant to do, like self-custody, as far as like going in and out of channels and things like that, and the costliness that would be incurred. Yeah. And so, you know, his argument was basically that, like, hey, at this point in time, like, this thing can't scale to everybody in the world without additional work being done on the network. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Just because the quote unquote scaling wars are over doesn't mean that we solved scaling. Lightning has made great advances since 2019, I think, when it went live on mainnet. And it's getting better. And I'm using it more than ever. I don't see the routing failures that I used to see a few years ago. More enterprises are getting into Lightning, helping with the liquidity. I mean, I gave a talk in Berlin in 2019 where I said, Lightning Network is never going to work as well as we want unless we get all of the exchanges and all the businesses on there. Just due to the way that money flows through an economy. Like in an economy, money doesn't just flow between individuals and peer-to-peer transactions. It flows from individuals to businesses and businesses to other businesses through supply chains and then businesses to employees. So you have to have all the pieces of that circular economy together on there in order for the liquidity flows to actually work. But Lightning is only one way of scaling. And I mean, even the Lightning white paper said, to facilitate enough volume for the whole world, we'd need bigger blocks. There are other ways of making Lightning more efficient, right? And this is where it kind of ties in full circle to the ossification debate, where I don't support just like any one change to the Bitcoin protocol, but my advice is that if we're trying to prioritize changes to the Bitcoin protocol, then changes that improve the scalability of Bitcoin and changes that improve the ability for people to do permissionless innovation, I think would be some of my top priorities. And so I'm sure you're familiar, like there's been a lot of drive chains debate over the past few months. There have been a number of other side chains and pegging proposals also this year, which I think are interesting, but they're very, very early. They're not production ready. And so I also think that side chains and the ability to have a trustless two-way peg between side chains is one of the sort of holy grails of permissionless innovation that we were promised in 2014 has yet to materialize. I'm somewhat heartened to see people continuing to work on that problem, because you could argue that a properly architected side chain, while it'll never have the exact same properties of Bitcoin, it may be good enough to onboard larger swaths of people and allow them to self-custody their keys to that.
Okay, interesting. So how do you how do you see like Bitcoin moving forward? And to the people that are like new into Bitcoin, just bought Bitcoin on Coinbase, they don't even have anything, they haven't withdrawn their funds, they haven't looked into any of this, and they hear us talk about conversations about changing Bitcoin, right? And the overall thought to most people who are buying it is like, this thing's set in stone. It's decentralized. Nobody can attack it. Nobody can do any of these certain things. What is like the recourse for a bad actor, and how do like how do the set of nodes and things like that defend against somebody going in and just saying like, hey, we're going to make more than 21 Bitcoin or 21 million Bitcoin.
Right. Well, I mean, there's fundamentally two different types of changes to any sort of protocol, any sort of network protocol. And this is where ossification also creeps in again. So essentially, you think of a protocol as a language. It's a way to communicate with other people or machines. And these internet protocols, of course, you're building networks. So really, every type of language has a network effect, right? Is, the more people that speak that language, the more valuable the language is, because obviously your total addressable market of people you can interact with in different ways becomes greater. This holds true for internet protocols as well, where if you're speaking the common language as a million other people or machines, you have a a huge disincentive to change that language in a way that breaks it so that you're no longer able to speak to those million people unless they choose to come along with you and, you know, quote unquote, learn the new language, AKA upgrade the software that runs the version of the protocol that you're all speaking. So what happens is, you know, I think it's Metcalfe's law is basically that like the value of a network is correlated to the size of the network. And so as these networks become larger and larger and larger, you have a greater and greater disincentive to break them in any way because you lose the network effect, the value of the network greatly diminishes. So the way that I've described this is that, you know, the result of these mechanics and incentives are such that as a network grows, it essentially the ability for it to change the protocol that is the underpinning of the network, that ability kind of gets crushed under the weight and the size of the network itself, because A, the incentives diminish greatly, and B, it's a coordination problem. Because no one owns the network, there's no one you can go to say, okay, we're all going to update at the same time to this new protocol. So the short version of all of this is that there's essentially two ways to change a protocol. One of them is non-backwards compatible. You're breaking it, and it's a forced update for everyone if they want to be able to still talk to each other. And the other one is you could actually think of it as a forwards compatible change, so that like all the people who are still speaking the old language, they can still speak to the people on the newer form of the protocol. They may just not know all of the same words, for example. So for most of its history, you know, at least for the past 10 years, probably 12 years, Bitcoin protocol changes have always been forwards compatible. And we call these soft forks versus a hard fork, which would be an incompatible change. And that has basically meant that people can keep running their node software and not have to worry about essentially getting kicked off the network or having compatibility problems with people. I have a whole article that goes into the technical minutia of this, but there was arguably like one hard fork in the first year or so that Satoshi did. But as far as we know, it didn't actually trigger a chain fork because there were so few people running the network. It was still possible to coordinate upgrades. Because Satoshi basically dictated them. And then, of course, we had a proliferation of hard forks in 2017 around the scaling debates and people creating a bunch of different versions of Bitcoin. Of course, all of those have, you know, plummeted in value like 99 point something percent over the past 5 years. But you know, once again, that is permissionless innovation, right? That is, it's really cool from a like a free markets perspective that people are able to do that. I kind of wish that some more people were able to do that because that was one of the best trades that I ever made. But anyways, we should really expect going forward that any protocol changes will need to be proposed as soft forks. I do have a theory that it may be possible to propose a hard fork if you do it in such a way that it's baked into the software like decades ahead of time, because for a variety of different reasons, you can't really run software that's more than 10 years old just due to the complexity of all the dependencies of operating systems and other libraries that are used to build it. But that's a whole other thing that I haven't really spoken about at length. That's one of my many sort of to-do essays to kind of talk about the fragility of modern software development and how that could potentially be leveraged to do a hard fork that is quote-unquote non-contentious.
Interesting. So you wrote an article that kind of goes back to this idea of growing networks and the incentives behind changing them. You wrote an article basically about the internet protocol and the email protocol and how that and how that ended up going from kind of a permissionless system like Bitcoin to something that is no longer like that. Would you mind kind of discussing that and its correlation to, you know, and its cautionary tale to Bitcoin?
Yeah, and I felt like I was particularly suited to talk about this because I was part of the problem. I was an email engineer for the first decade of my life, worked for a company that went from sending a few hundred thousand emails a day to over 100 million emails a day on behalf of our clients. So we were one of the major email marketing service providers out there. And, I had to interface, both at the technical level and kind of at the human level with other participants in the ecosystem. And so the short version is that SMTP, the email sending protocol, was developed, I think, in the late 70s or maybe the 80s. And it was developed as a very simple protocol. And the goal of it was to, as much as possible, guarantee the delivery of the message that you're sending. And it worked quite well. And for the first few decades, the network of email servers out there, it was quite niche and it was a volunteer network, and people were generally happy to help each other out if they were having problems. Things started to change in the 90s when AOL came out, when millions of randos started flooding the internet. And when you have millions of people, inevitably a small percentage of them will be dicks. And so some of them started abusing the email protocol and sending spam, aka unsolicited email. And this was a problem because the email protocol was not developed or designed to deal with unwanted messages. The assumption was that you would want any messages that were sent to you. So over the next 15, 20 years, this became a sort of cat and mouse battle between the email server administrators and the spammers. And essentially, over the next few decades, a lot of email administrators gave up because the cost of fighting the spam was too high. Like, we tried things from Bayesian filters, aka like looking for trigger keywords. That didn't work very well, had a lot of false positives, resulted in a lot of desired emails getting sent to spam, created ever and ever more complex systems of trying to score and filter spam, which didn't really work. Eventually turned to what you could call reputation systems, which is basically various providers creating blacklists. They would just start monitoring as much email activity as possible, and they would assign scores to like IP addresses and domains and any sort of identifying information. And then you would subscribe to those blacklists, and that would be how you would stop it. That was problematic too, but this was something that I dealt with on a regular basis at my job, is that sometimes, and we had a wide variety of clients, and most of them were great, but sometimes we would have one client come in and they would like import a bunch of email addresses that they had bought somewhere and that had not opted in to receive email, and they would start spamming. And sometimes we would get entire IP ranges blocked, even though 99% of our customers were doing the right thing. That 1% could, well, we actually called it peeing in the pool, because they would basically they would screw up our entire IP pool. And so we would actually have to end up segregating off different ranges of IP addresses for like the good and the bad senders. And if you got bad enough, we would fire you as a client because you were harming us more than, the revenue that you were giving us was worth it. So, these things kept getting more and more complicated, and they turned like away from more technical ways of blocking spam to more sort of human relations type of things. Like, we ended up having to hire professional deliverability specialists, and they weren't technical people. Rather, they were people who would curate ongoing relationships with all of the big internet service providers, so that they basically had a direct line to the people who held the keys to the blacklists, so that when
Wow.
something happened, they could go beg for forgiveness from these ISPs to say, "Yeah, we had this one client and they're an asshole and we fired them and it won't happen again."
Yeah.
And so the short version of all of that is that eventually Where we are today is that something like 90% of all email users are captured by 10 companies that run the email services. So basically, SMTP is no longer a sovereign protocol. You can download email server software. You can run email server software. There's plenty of free open source email software out there. And you will find that even if you fully obey all of the rules of the SMTP protocol, then your emails will, in many cases, still not get delivered. And the reason for that is that over the decades, we created all of these new like meta layers of protocol rules that are unfortunately governed by centralized gatekeepers. And so it is really the boys' club of email now, where if you're not in the club, your emails get black holed. And so as a result, the only way that you can reliably send email, and I do this myself because I have a newsletter that I send out once a month, you have to subscribe to someone who's in the club and has all of those relationships. And that's how you can ensure your email gets delivered. And so is that good or bad? Does email work today? Billions of people use email and it works for them, but the email that they are using is not the same email as 20 or 30 years ago. And I guess you could argue philosophically about whether or not that matters. I think we would say it does matter, but that is just an example of a way that a fully decentralized sovereign protocol can become centralized and captured. And I think it's a fascinating history because there was no bad guy. Like, there was no evil actor that was like trying to manipulate things and trying to like capture the protocol. It was actually a result of dozens, if not hundreds, of decisions over decades by many different people who were just, they were following their incentives. And the incentive was to solve the problems that the users were complaining about and make shit work, without regard to, some of these more philosophical quandaries, like being able to use the protocol directly without having to ask permission.
I actually have that portion of your article highlighted because that made me think, and I don't, you don't have to comment on this at all, but it made me think of politics in general, like how many actors are just acting the way that they're incentivized and not really out of malice, right? Like not out of, but they end up, again, stripping away freedoms through policy changes and doing things like that. And just that, maybe there isn't, the one big bad boss, right? And it's just everybody acting to their incentives that end up kind of centralizing, centralizing things like the way that they've done.
I mean, this also kind of ties into the self-custody stuff I was talking about, which is it's human nature to seek the path of least resistance, to find the easiest possible solution to the problem, without thinking about all the nuanced potential like second order effects.
Well, let's get into the self-custody stuff a little bit. And if you wouldn't mind, take into consideration that some people watching this, or perhaps the people watching, have no experience sending a Bitcoin transaction at this point. They've just bought on an exchange, on Coinbase or something like that. Can you break it down from the simplest terms of like what is self-custody? What is a Bitcoin wallet, right? And what are the steps to simple forms of self-custody versus something like a multi-sig, and then what you guys offer at Casa and the point of that?
So what is a Bitcoin wallet? There's two main components to a wallet, and this is where it can get confusing for some people. One is key management. If you don't have the private keys, then you can't apply the correct cryptographic signatures to your transaction to essentially prove to the network that you have the right, the ownership to that Bitcoin and the ability to move it. There are many other aspects of wallet software that basically, and it's basically accounting. It's, you know, looking at the blockchain data, finding the deposits and withdrawals that are related to the keys that are held by the wallet, and then, you know, managing all of those unspent transaction outputs. It can get pretty gnarly, but the average user shouldn't really need to know about that stuff. I see a variety of levels of custody in this space, and I actually just added a new one recently. So at the worst level of custody is where you buy Bitcoin on some sort of service, and they don't even have the ability for you to request to withdraw it to self-custody. That is, it's not even an IOU for Bitcoin. It's actually an IOU for fiat. Like if that company goes under, then you're probably never going to get Bitcoin. You might get some fiat equivalent value back. The next level is if you buy Bitcoin from an exchange or service provider that does support withdrawals. If you do that, you have an IOU for Bitcoin, and you, if everything goes well, can request to redeem it to get the actual Bitcoin, you know, sent to you into a self-custody wallet. So then the first level of self-custody is you have created a wallet where you have the keys, aka, you know, you have a seed phrase that was given to you that you're holding on to, hopefully very securely and multiple redundant backups and so on and so forth. And once you get to this level, you no longer have an IOU. When you have the IOU, you're going and you're clicking on a button in an app somewhere that is, it's asking the third party who has the actual keys to, you know, craft a transaction and send it on your behalf. And of course, they can refuse that request for any number of reasons, including, you know, technical problems, insolvency, or in some cases, even like law enforcement dragnet sweeps. They might freeze your account for suspicious activity or whatever.
Or some of them never
If
even
you,
bought it in
yeah,
the first place.
but if you have the keys in any type of self-custody wallet, you're not asking for permission, you're just following the Bitcoin protocol. So as long as you apply the correct cryptographic signature that matches whatever the conditions for your Bitcoin deposit address are, and of course you pay a market rate fee for the miners to include it in the block, then you should expect, you know, your Bitcoin is going to move to wherever you instruct it to, you know, with that transaction. Beyond that, what it turns into is more of a question of how resilient and robust is your self-custody setup. So this is where we start talking about things of, are you using a single key wallet? If so, where are those keys stored? Are they stored like on your computer, your laptop, your mobile phone? If so, those are considered hot keys. Whenever the keys themselves are on an internet connected device, this is arguably still safer than having the keys with a third party, but when they're on an internet connected device, you're essentially putting them in a position where there's this door that billions of people could potentially walk through, right? You know, you're connected to a network with billions of people, and we know there are some malicious actors out there who will try to get to your keys in a variety of different ways. There are hundreds of different ways that you can, you know, have your keys stolen from you if they're on an internet connected device. So what do you do? If you have a non-negligible amount of Bitcoin, I would say if you have more than $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, it really starts to make financial sense to invest $50 or $100 into a hardware device to keep those keys safe. And, you know, people generally think of Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, Foundation. I mean, there's tons of them out there. Think of these as your offline vault, and they basically protect you from all of the internet-based attackers and malware and keyloggers and stuff. So it's a great way to put you in the sort of top several percent, like strongest Bitcoin holders out there. But this is still a single key, and if you start to get to the point where you have a lot of value, like enough value that it would hurt to lose, you would lose sleep at night. It might materially affect your financial future. This is where you need to start thinking about how do I eliminate single points of failure? The pro of Bitcoin is, of course, you can be your own bank. You can store and transfer and manipulate your money on this ledger without asking permission from anyone. It's a great power that we've never really had before. But the flip side is, with great power comes responsibility. So Bitcoin is a very unforgiving protocol. If you mess up, if it's a single key and it gets either stolen or lost, that's game over. It's a catastrophic failure, and there is no support technician that can help you get your money back.
Well, you can't call
So,
Bitcoin, the Bitcoin helpline.
pretty much, I mean, you can call the helpline by posting on a forum, and people will say sorry for your loss. But so how do we protect against that? Well, you have to be upfront in your protection and how you architect your keys and essentially manage them. And so, if your keys are in a single place, you're vulnerable to any number of types of theft or loss. If it's one seed phrase, yes, putting it on a hardware device protects you from online attackers, but what if that device gets damaged, lost, stolen, or whatever? Then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, what about my backups? Okay, I have dozens of pages of essays about backups because that can get really complicated. Most people back up their seed phrases in a what we call clear text or unencrypted format. Which means that those backups are still vulnerable to physical attackers. Basically, anyone who can view that backup can load your keys into some software and steal all the money. And once again, you have no recourse. So, how do we get around this? Well, you basically need to set up your wallet so that one key is not sufficient to move the funds. And this is where multi-sig, multi-signature comes into play. You could also just think of it as multi-keys. And so the protocol, which is programmable, allows us to define arbitrary conditions. Like we can say, hey, we're actually going to create a wallet with three keys, and we need signatures from two keys to spin from it. Or we can create a wallet that has is made up of five keys, and you have to have three keys sign. And so you can start to see how this gives you some more robustness and resiliency. I think when you combine having multiple keys with storing those keys and their backups in multiple geographic locations and using them on multiple different vendors of hardware devices, you're really able to leverage this magic of what we call additive security. And you can basically think of it as strength through variety, by sort of heterogeneous architecture instead of homogeneous. Like basically, if you had five keys and you put them all on Trezors, you're in a really good position there, but there could still theoretically be a supply chain attack of Trezor that somehow results in all of those keys being compromised. And that's an extreme edge case, but this is where we're getting to extreme levels of security here. So basically the culmination of all of that, the best practices that I've come to learn over the years, this is what CASA does, is that we have architected what we consider to be extreme levels of security while still being able to offer a level of usability that doesn't require you to be highly technical. And we also combine that with a level of support that's very hard to find with other wallet providers. You want to actually be able to get on a phone call with someone and think through all of the different decisions that need to be made in your key management, or if you hit some weird error that you don't understand, it's easier to talk to a human who spends all day dealing with this stuff instead of trying to crawl through support documentation and volunteer forums and stuff. So we approach this all from a multi-pronged approach of usability, security, and support. And unlike a lot of other wallets out there, we don't monetize you through your data or advertising to you or trying to sell you other services. We're actually a very upfront subscription fee. You pay the fee, you get the service. We're not trying to collect
Is that a flat fee for you guys? Okay. So for somebody who, like you said, might have only $1,000 of Bitcoin, it might not make sense to, I don't even know what that fee is, but,
We do have a free, hot wallet. If you only have a few $100, then if you just want to play around, you can definitely test it out. But our bread and butter is the multi-sig self-custody. Yeah. And we have tiers all the way. The sort of more do-it-yourself 2 of 3 tier is basically like $20 a month. And then our highest private client tier is actually $5,000 a year. And that includes a lot of stuff, including sort of bespoke inheritance planning.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, because when I think about, my stack and, as stuff grows, right, as we get through, next halving cycles and things like that, like, what does it make sense to do? Because you want that complete self-sovereignty, but also it does come with a lot of the idea that somebody might have x amount of money, whether it be $10,000 that might be life-changing to them, to something that grows to $100 or $1 million worth of Bitcoin, right? And there's almost like a natural progression, right? Like you might have started with a single signature wallet, but as time goes on, that becomes a larger part of your portfolio. And so do you see kind of people transitioning from stage to stage? Maybe they start at that hot wallet stage and then go, okay, I want to eliminate these different attack vectors here and kind of continue on that route.
Yeah, pretty much. My general suggestion is that you should not have a level of security that feels appropriate for what your current value of your Bitcoin is. You should have a level of security that feels appropriate for whatever 10 times the current value is, because, as we know, that value can change drastically very quickly, and you don't want to get kind of caught unawares in a bad security posture.
Yeah. For the geographically distributed multi-signature keys, what are some of the challenges with that in general? I mean, I've heard people kind of just be like, well, if you need to send something, the coordination of efforts behind getting access to those keys to actually, sign a transaction can be difficult.
This is where, having client advisors, help you make some decisions around this, because everybody's situation is different. We've seen everything from people just distributing devices amongst their family in the sort of same local city or town, which is fairly convenient, versus on the extreme end, people who are worried about nation state attacks actually distributing their keys across different countries that are not particularly friendly with each other. And so There are many decisions that have to be made when it comes to your self-custody architecture. And at the end of the day, pretty much all of them have to do with finding what you believe is your appropriate trade-off between convenience and security. And so, placing your keys in geographically distant locations, obviously the further apart they are, the more difficult it is to craft that transaction. This is both good and bad. Obviously, it's less convenient if you're in a hurry. Though I would say, we offer multiple different architectures. So like if you have a 3 of 5, you could also have a 2 of 3 and a single sig, and treat it like, checking account, savings account, like extreme long-term investment account. You don't have to only have one architecture. Yeah. But the flip side is like the further geographically apart your keys are, the safer they are against like environmental losses, natural disasters. And one thing that some people worry about, it's still an edge case, but, wrench attacks. So I've had a lot of people ask me over the years, how do I protect myself from wrench attacks? And the only conclusion that I can come to is that if you're in a situation where you're under duress, the only way that your Bitcoin can be protected is if you literally can't access it. And yeah. So if accessing your Bitcoin requires you to travel to multiple locations, and some of those can actually be, high level of physical security, like a safety deposit box at a bank, mm-hmm. or at another private security service, then it becomes very difficult to imagine an attacker willing to endanger themselves by having to, hold you hostage and move you around. A physical attacker wants to get in and out as quickly as possible. The whole issues around like duress situations, in many cases, it's still too early. Like we don't have a lot of data around the different ways it can go. I mean, this is one of my many projects, is keeping track of as many physical attacks against Bitcoiners as possible, but it's still relatively rare. I think there have been like 130 known attacks in the entire history that have been publicized. Yeah. So, far, far, far more people, of course, lose their Bitcoin to insolvent custodians or hackers or whatever. But if we're talking about, protecting yourself from every possible form of loss, then that extreme case is an interesting one to speculate about.
Yeah, it's really just an interesting topic in general. I mean, and the opinions and thoughts on it change so much from, a couple $100 to a million, right? Like just the idea of like, I'll just put it in a single signature wallet, all the way up to like, holy crap, that's a horrible idea. Like who wants, $1 million sitting in, on a plate or something stuck underneath their table or wherever they choose to hide the thing.
The problem is that I think the average person only thinks about the happy path, aka mm-hmm. the case where everything is going well. We tend not to be adversarial minded. And so that's where my paranoia and thinking about and seeing a lot of the edge case failures that have happened over the years have really shaped my thinking.
Yeah. What's just quickly before we wrap things up here, what's a good instance, or what's your guys' solution to like multi-generational like Bitcoin holdings? So like passing down your Bitcoin inheritance planning.
Yeah. So inheritance is tricky because you want to architect a setup where presumably you are the only one who has access to the coins right now, but then magically if you die, some sort of switch gets flipped and your beneficiaries can then access those funds. And so the cool thing about multisig is that it actually allows you to create setups like that, because you can have a threshold of keys set up that are only accessible after your death. You can do that by distributing keys. Once again, like in a, you can put one in a safety deposit box that has beneficiaries listed on it. So, you know, they have to provide proof of death. CASA, we ourselves can facilitate that with the one key that we hold. And then you can, this is where it starts to get personalized. Like if you have, you know, a spouse, you can share a key with, but this is also why our inheritance solutions are fairly bespoke, is because it does, it depends on your own, setup, you know, what your family and beneficiaries look like, who you have, who, you know, you would be willing to be a key holder. Because once again, these things, they're not set it and forget it. There is ongoing maintenance required. And, you know, even if you have someone who is a key holder that is not like actively using the key and signing, you still need to do essentially health checks every once in a while to make sure that they haven't lost it.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. All right. So one of the questions, if you didn't know, I work in the elevator industry. So one of the questions I ask every guest before we sign off is, give me your 30-second elevator pitch for Bitcoin.
Fair enough. So, you know, Bitcoin is an open project that is aiming to be the optimal form of money. And anyone who wants to participate can weigh in and can contribute their time, skills, and resources to trying to make the form of money that is agreed upon to be the best in existence.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Jamison, give everybody a sign off here. Let them know where they can find you, where they can read up on all of the great work that you put out there, and how they can get in touch with CASA.
Yeah, so a lot of people know me for my educational resources page. If you just go to bitcoin.page, you'll find thousands of links and dozens of different categories for whatever Bitcoin rabbit hole you want to dive down. You can also find me on Twitter. It's just LOPP. I'm also on Nostr, but I couldn't tell you my NPub off the top of my head. But you can find all of my other social media contact info on my site. And it's CASA.io, CASA.io for the company if you want to learn more about our security offerings.
All right. Awesome. Thank you for everything you do. I appreciate you joining me here, and continued good fortune.
Thanks for having me.